Welcome to the Gravity Well. Here we break down heavy ideas into small buckets that you can handle. Our mission is simple. Help us work through your dilemmas in conversation and process. Together, we and our community will face your dilemmas and make the world a better place for all. In the spirit of truth, I acknowledge I'm a settler on stolen Blackfoot Treaty 7 and Métis Districts 5 and 6 territories. I take reconciliation by seeking the wisdom of elders and individuals who aim to restore water, air, land, life, or community. A healthy living relationship with the earth and each other is our guide. I am pleased to be sitting down with Carrie Lynn Sparvier. Thank you so much for joining me. So the reason why we're here together is my friend Holly Standing Ready brought us together after an incident that occurred on our show. So we had a guest that we supported over four episodes without appreciating that we were misrepresenting him. Definitely has credentials in terms of education around Blackfoot knowledge, but is not a Black member of the Blackfoot community. And we seek to hold conversations with people that we are working together with in bringing people through the crisis that we're facing. So the social, environmental, and economic crisis. And so Holly connected me with you, and I'm so glad to sit down with you. So why don't we start with a little bit of an introduction of yourself, please?
So the name I go by right now is Carrie Lynn Sparvier. I am two-spirit trans woman. And my definition of two-spirit is that I actually identify as both genders inside. I had hidden my true identity as a two-spirit for 52 years, presenting as a male. And the last 3.5 years since I've come out and publicly acclaimed as two-spirit, I have walked the feminine path. So in order for me to understand that half, I don't know how long that journey will take or whether or not there will be a balance. I am hoping at some point there might be. But at this point, I have to walk the feminine side of my
journey.
Well, and of my identity as well. Yeah. It is quite a journey. I've learned a lot, that's for sure. As a two-spirit knowledge keeper, I'm from White Bear First Nation, which is in southeast Saskatchewan. I am actually Lakota Yapi, which is Lakota Sioux. We are descended from Hunkpapa. From down in the States. Well, our descendants actually came up from the States right after the little Battle of Little Bighorn with Chief Sitting Bull. So we are descendants of that group that came up. My legal name is Gary Cassette. I am starting the process to change. I am not taking away the Gary Cassette part. I'm actually adding the Carrie Lynn. Portion to that name. So I've started that process. My traditional name is Chishin Guak Wewesakapo, which is a combination between Anishinaabe and Lakota Yapi. Chishin Guak, it means big pine tree in Anishinaabe, and Wewesakapo means standing tall against the wind in Lakota. So short form in English is big pine standing ready. So that's my traditional name.
That's beautiful. Was your name given to you at birth?
The name Gary, my birth name was actually Gary Sparvier.
Okay.
But I am from the Wewesakapo family. That's the traditional name.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And my name, how I came about to get the name Carrie Lynn, I've had that since I was 5.5 years old. I'm actually 60 scuba and residential school survivor. And for the first 5.5 years after I was taken away at 1 month, I was in 5 different foster homes. I went to 6 years residential school starting at 5.5 years old. And it was in residential school that I found out that I was different. Inside, that I had both boy and girl in me, born or assigned male at birth. I went to residential school, and I'm left-handed, and I went to a Catholic residential school. And then the sister superior kind of took me as a pet project to convert me to being right-handed, because at that time being left-handed was considered evil. The word left in Latin is the word sinister. So they interpreted that as being left-handed people were evil. So therefore, they needed to be brought to the light and be converted to right-handed. And they were very unsuccessful with me. And part of the punishment for continuing to use my left hand is they did what some call petticoating. They put me in the girls' uniform, made me sit on the girls' side of the classroom because we were segregated, boys and girls. Mm-hmm. And eventually I moved into the girls' dorm and lived as a girl for 5.5 years. And I realized very quickly after that happened that it was not wrong, that it felt right, that I belonged there. And that was revealing to me. So I spent 5.5 years as a girl in residential school. And then when I got taken out and permanently placed in another foster family, I had to learn how to be a boy again because I was going to a rural school, like a public school in rural Saskatchewan. And it was in a Catholic area of the province of Saskatchewan and not a place to be different. Right. And being born boy, I had to be very boy. So, you know, football, soccer, hockey, boy stuff.
Right.
That was very frowned upon on being a girl. However, the funny thing was that the best friends I had in school from grade 7 to grade 12 were girls. I actually got friends that were boys around grade 9 when other boys realized that I was hanging around with the 3 cutest girls in the class. And so they made friends with me in order to make friends with the girls. And we ended up for 4 years being like a core group. You know, so if you saw one of us, the other 5 are somewhere close. Right. When I turned 16, I had a 1972 Ford Granada convertible. It was red and it could hold a ton of teenagers. Nice. Because back then they didn't have seatbelt laws.
Right. Yeah. I remember piling in the back of trucks.
Right. And we burned purple gas in that car. We had purple gas. Never got stopped by the cops, funny enough. It was a big land yacht. Right. So, but it was very interesting growing up. From there, I went to university for 2 years, took engineering. So I was very mathy. And engineering at the University of Saskatchewan was not, there was no girls.
Yeah.
You didn't see any girls. But after 2 years, I realized I didn't want to be an engineer. I kind of thought engineers were a little weird, even though I was taking it. We'd go to a bar and all we talk about was engineering.
Right.
Instead of chasing girls. And I was very interested in girls too. I withdrew at the end of 2 years. And I went and I worked in the oil patch for 3 years. And then again, another very male, macho, alpha male kind of work. And I did that for 2 years. And then the National Energy Program hit from Trudeau Senior. And the oil industry here in Alberta took a hit. And I got laid off. So real, real bucket for punishment. I went and I joined the military. And again, not an environment to be different. So continued hiding. The Carrie Lynn side, presenting very alpha male Gary. And I ended up being in for 27 years. In that time, I got married in my first 3 years. So I continued on. Met a lovely little Acadian girl from Nova Scotia. Again, very Catholic. I've been married now to her. We're still married for 38 years, but a 27-year career in the Canadian Forces in the Navy. Mm-hmm. Got to travel the world, and I ended up my last 7 years in the military was actually I got posted here to Calgary as a recruiter. I did a 3-year stint, and then I transferred over to the primary reserves as a recruiter, still in the same office, but I took over the role of Aboriginal recruiter for Western Canada. So I covered everything from Thunder Bay West, including the three territories. So I had a chance to, as a recruiter, to reconnect with my Indigenous heritage and started going back to my traditional beliefs and everything. In the mid-90s, I had done a healing circle or a healing journey with an elder out on the West Coast. She was Haida. I worked with her at the Longhouse on the Songhees Reserve because I was suffering from PTSD from my residential school experiences.
Right.
And it was starting to affect my work. So I had a very good boss and decided to help me. And he said, if I could get you help, will you take it? And the smartest thing I did is say yes. And so I was working with therapists, psychologists, and with the elder 3 days a week. And that helped me. I worked, I did that steady for 2 years. And then I got posted out here to Calgary. That was right before my posting. Something happened about 3.5 years ago. And that was when they found the 215 unmarked graves at the former site of the Kamloops Residential School. And that really triggered my PTSD really, really bad. And in order to try and bring it back under control, I decided to, well, I offered at work to do a healing ceremony. And so my coworkers and I, we went out to where our flag was and in front of the office and did a circle around it. And I smudged the circle. We did a prayer circle. Each one was allowed to say a little blurb or whatever. At the end of that, I drummed the flag to half mast, and then I sang a healing song with my drum. The staff sergeant brought in coffee and donuts to our staff room, and we were just having a little social. And somebody from across the room asked me why I was using a woman's hand drum, not a man's, and I didn't think anybody would know the difference, but there is. In the Lakota, a woman isn't allowed to use a touch a drum, right? She's allowed to sing, but not touch a drum. But I am two spirit, and therefore I am allowed to touch a drum. The drum I actually have was given to me by another elder, but it is a woman's hand drum from the Anishinaabe Nation, and it has sides and it's not very deep. It's only like a couple inches deep, whereas a man's drum is either 4 to 6 inches deep. And the reason why it's called a man's drum is because it has a deeper voice, right? The deeper bass. Mm-hmm. And a woman's hand drum is a little lighter bass. It's still a bass, but it's a little higher in pitch. And that therefore it talks with a woman's voice. Right. So therefore it's a woman's hand drum. So they asked me that and caught me off guard. And when they asked me a second time and everybody was silent and waiting for an answer, I decided that I can't hide anymore. It was time. And so I took that big step and I came out and I said, it's because I am two spirit that I use a woman's hand drum. Of course, right away I got an F slur, right, from somebody, an older person in the room. And I looked at him and I said, no, I said, that's a sexual orientation. I said, I'm not. That's not me. This is a gender identity. And I explained to them what two-spirit means. And I looked at them and I said, and for your comfort, just so that you know, I said, my male half is straight. It's my female half that's gay. And I said, so you have nothing to offer me.
Yeah.
Right. So he kind of left in embarrassment because everybody kind of laughed at him and then came and congratulated me for coming out. Okay. So I got some very good support at work. In the meantime, they also made a gender-neutral washroom for me at work. So just so that you know, I work at Calgary City Police. I am not a police officer. I'm a peace officer. So I'm only doing certain things. I don't respond to like domestics or anything violent or anything like that. I don't do that. However, I do work with Calgary City Police. And as a result of me coming out and them making a gender-neutral washroom in my precinct, because if you do a change in one city building, you have to do in the mall. All the precincts now have a gender-neutral washroom, as well as I think City Hall and various other city buildings are now doing that as well, converting that as a result. So as far as I know, I am the first open transgender woman as a member of Calgary City Police. I believe there in 2016 there was a transgender man. I don't know their name, and even if I did, I wouldn't. Right. Don't have the privilege of outing them.
Right.
But gender neutral washrooms are now the norm, which is good. And that's a very big step forward, because everybody uses gender neutral washrooms every day. Your bathroom at home is a gender neutral washroom. There's no reason for it.
They should all be gender neutral.
Yeah, exactly.
There's in Europe, it's very common to have, you know, just a room and then a central sink.
Right.
And I know a lot of my, I have two boys in high school, and most of the high schools have that set up.
Yeah.
Where it's just a private room for.
Private little stalls that have
the central.
You close the door and it locks the door, right?
Right.
And it's fully enclosed. I recently had been to a couple of places this summer where, and one of them was convention center, and it was just long rows of little cubicles. You go in, you go to do your business, and then you come up and you use common sense.
Right.
And I think that's wonderful because that makes sense.
It does. It just makes sense. Practical sense. You know, I think of a show, and this is a diversion, but Ally McBeal had this back in the 90s.
And how this came about at my precinct was that 5 months in, one of the staff sergeant asked, says, "I'm just out of curiosity, what washroom are you using?" And I said, "Well, I'm not using a washroom here." And he goes, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, out of respect for the women, I'm not using the women's washroom, right? I said, I know the girls in my office would be okay with it because they support me. I said, but they're not the only women in the building,
right?
And I said, so out of the respect for them, I'm not. And I said, I'm not using the men's washroom. I said, because lipstick and female attributes don't go well when you walk by the urinals and you get people stage fright." And I said, so I'm not going to be using the men's washroom either. So I'm actually going across the road to Tim Hortons or the McDonald's and use the women's washroom over there. I said, because they don't know me over there. And he says, that's not right. He says, you need a facility. So they converted one of the single stall men's washrooms in the building to a gender neutral washroom. And they also, he said, would you like a locker in there as well? Because when I was presenting as Gary, I had a locker in the men's locker room. And so they put a locker in there as well. So I have a private room to change to go to the gym.
Yeah, right. I'm so glad that they've accommodated that. Your journey has been a remarkable one. You know, I don't want to step over what you've shared here. I think it sort of fits in with why we came to this conversation too. Cultural appropriation is a word that comes to mind for me from
So cultural appropriation, there's a few different aspects of it, right? One of it is the one that we saw most commonly is costumes. People making costumes that resembled our sacred and traditional regalia. But selling it in costume stores, right? It's not only how it's very demeaning to us, and it not only is it demeaning, but it also perpetuates stereotypes, like bad stereotypes. And one of the biggest bad stereotypes is the Hollywood movies of, you know, the early, like, 20s, 30s, 40s westerns, you know, all natives were savages, and, you know, they were all on the warpath, and they were all, you know, out to kill white people, and you know, and they attacked every wagon train there ever was or whatever. And that's simply not true. Again, it was Hollywood. It was sensationalized. It was made more sensational in order to sell the movies, right? And then you had the hero, right, that always came to save the day, like the Lone Ranger type, mm-hmm. right? If there was an indigenous person, they were the sidekick, like Tonto.
Right.
Growing up, I actually hated the Lone Ranger. I hated that show. I hated Tonto. And the reason why I hated them is because he looked like me. He looked native. He looked like me. Right. Whereas previously, you had actors that were made up to look.
Right.
Like, you know,
that's interesting.
Because... And they were white actors that made to look native, right? Mm-hmm. Right. You had Dustin Hoffman, you had Steve McQueen, you know, a lot of those Hollywood actors, if there was, if you needed an actor, well, right, they didn't put an indigenous person in there.
No.
They put a white person made up, right? Yes. Again, it was the worst form of cultural appropriation, and that is our version of, like, red face. Like it's our version of blackface, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And that that is like the worst type of cultural appropriation in my mind is to do that.
Yeah.
And then take things out of context.
Right.
From Indigenous people. Like our powwow is a celebration. It's actually a ceremony, the powwow dancing. It's cultural appropriation to call it an office get together a powwow.
Right.
Because you're using the name of a ceremony.
Right.
For an office like get together. Like it's a meeting. Let's all have a powwow. But no, that's not a powwow. Right? Powwow is sacred.
Right. Yeah,
that's another cultural appropriation of it. So it's not only just clothing, articles of clothing, and it could be words, yes, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, one, and I think this might be a reach, but I want to put it in here as somebody, as I mentioned, geophysicist background in oil and gas. One of the things that really concerns me is redwashing. I don't know if you're familiar with this term, but it's when something that is presented as a collaboration with Indigenous communities, when really it is, you can participate provided that you also
are doing
industrial harm.
You know, you talk to one Indigenous person, oh, we did our cultural obligation, we consulted. Right. With the Indigenous community, when you only talk to one person, that's not Indigenous consultation, mm-hmm. right? Indigenous consultation is when you approach the band, either through chief and council, and talk to the elders.
Right.
You need to talk to the elders, not just the chief, not just one or two counselors, right? You need to talk to the elders. Arrange a meeting with the elders. Get the elders together. Right. And that is how you consult but you got to allow them an active voice in the decision making and listen to them, not just do your due diligence. Oh, yeah. You talk to them. And then whatever they said, you disregard. That's not consultation again.
Right. Well, and that sort of leads into my second question for you. So I agree. There's a lot of assumption, you know, box checking exercise where we've spoken to chief and council. We gave them 3 weeks. They didn't complain in those 3 weeks. So therefore moving forward.
Well, that's the thing too. A lot of companies, they're money driven, right? Money driven, and time is money. Well, in the Indigenous cultures, things happen when they happen. And it, you know what, if it takes 3 weeks, if it takes 3 months, it might take 3 years for them to think about it and get back to you on things. You can't put a time limit on it because in the Indigenous culture, take for instance, I'm wearing a watch. And what I do when I go on the res is I take it off. Because when I go to the res, things happen when they happen. I'm back with my people. When we meet when it's supposed to happen.
Right, not at 7 o'clock.
Not on a timetable, right? Not
very different. And like you said, there's this ingrained time. I wanted to touch on a question we touched on before we started here.
Yeah.
From your Two-Spirit angle. So one of the things that I think persists in our decision making is the idea of binary thinking. So this idea that, you know, this consequence, as long as it's successful, I can keep moving forward, right? If each incident is a quote unquote win, then we're moving forward rather than thinking about the consequences of the things we do and how it comes back around to us. So I think this is part of why the trans community is being isolated in terms of you're representing this different way of thinking. And I'm curious what your thoughts are from your experience. Do you think that, there is an opportunity for people to learn to think more consequentially?
Okay. Yeah. First of all, you mentioned the word binary thinking, and that actually stems from a way to control the masses, starting with, you know, the Dark Ages and the Renaissance. It was a way the churches and the rich used to subjugate and keep people poor, right? And weaponize religion.
Right.
Weaponize religion. And in that is binary thinking, you know, only male, female, marry for procreation to get more followers of the church is the ultimate goal, right? And the economy, right? To keep the rich, and has permeated all of like European culture, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what we call Western culture. However, it wasn't the norm if you looked at the grand scheme of things on the entire planet. Mm-hmm. Other places, Far East, Middle East, Africa, you look at North and South America, which wasn't so-called discovered yet. Those different cultures had different ways of thinking. They didn't think in the binary. There was gender, for example, was a spectrum.
Right.
Everywhere else in the world, but Europe, because they had the church's influence to use that binary thinking in brainwashing the masses and keeping them. And I like to think that the Catholic Church was the original gatekeeper. They were the ones that brought in, if you don't listen to us, if you don't be good, if you don't give us all your crop and everything, you know, and you don't listen to the clergy, you're not going to get to heaven, right? You know, if you do any act that is not approved by the church, you're not going to get to heaven, right? You have to go through us to get to heaven, right? So that's gatekeeping in its finest form, right? So, and that's what the church has pushed,
right?
Everywhere else, there was different genders.
Yeah, well, even in Greek mythology, right? Like we've learned about this as well. And, you know, hermaphrodism was revered.
Well, Julius Caesar was known to be the man's woman and the woman's man.
Right. So much female, like right? they dressed as women when they performed.
But he was you would probably consider him bisexual, right. Julius Caesar.
Right, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Right. The Romans. Well, I mean, look at Caligula. Took sexual deviation to the extreme.
Right.
But the gist of it is that the Christian churches that weaponized religion, and had really pushed binaryism in order to control the masses.
Right.
And they use that. And you start off at very early age, to accept that, and that's the norm, and that's what's expected, and you try to fit in that when you're raised in that environment, even if you are different and you know you're different. Mm-hmm. Right. But if you read the Bible, God loves all his children. God made them the way they were supposed to be.
Right.
God doesn't make mistakes, and if I'm a mistake, then God's flawed.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is just it. It's and actually, like, you know, from, again, I always like to bring it back to a scientific perspective. Yeah.
Even the scientific perspective, you want to go to get into the genetics, right? There's not just XY.
That's
there's
right.
XXY. Yeah. There's XXXX. There's XXYY, right? And there's a combination of all the X's and Y's. And how do they determine gender? You're trying to fit them into two boxes when they don't fit.
No,
you're trying
precisely.
To put round pegs in a square hole, right? For a lot of people, there's intersex.
Great.
There is men born with women's brains, which is what I was.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, this is just it. It's a spectrum, and like another example of this hierarchical decision making, like you're describing, is in the medical system, mostly tested on male. Most things, right?
Exactly.
And then we only see when we're treating people, we're not necessarily treating them properly because we didn't look at the spectrum when we made these medical decisions.
That's right.
For example, this potential trans policy that our provincial government is pushing, which is to not allow children to be to have proper hormone balances as their gender can be fluid.
And the trouble with this is that it's not only going to affect trans kids, it's also going to affect straight kids, cis kids.
Oh, wow.
And that's what a lot of people don't realize. What about that child, that girl or that boy that starts puberty at 6, 7, or 8?
Right.
Right? They're different. You got to think with a 6, 7, or 8-year-old mind. They're different. They're going to be ostracized. They're going to be picked on. They're going to be bullied, right? Because they're different. on the other side of the spectrum, there's the 15, 16, 17-year-old that hasn't gone through puberty yet or started yet in the locker room. They got no hair. They still got a juvenile body in a room full of young adults.
Right.
They get picked on.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. That's so true.
And the thing is that also can lead to suicide.
Yes.
Right. Like bullying. I'd like to say, bring a little bit of pride in here. You know, pride isn't about making your kids different. It's not about making them gay or trans or anything. Pride is about stopping queer kids from becoming dead kids. That's what pride is actually about, right? And this legislation, again, not allowing any kind of gender-affirming care for kids, you're affecting cis kids too, not just... In fact, there's going to be a higher percentage of cis kids affected by this than trans kids.
Right, just by the numbers.
Just by the numbers.
Yeah.
Right?
That's absolutely such an
example. What's the percentage of people that are trans versus the percentage of people that are cis but yet are early bloomers or late bloomers?
Right.
Right? Yeah. You would rather want to be where with the rest of your peers, be in puberty at 10, 11, and 12, 13, right? Not at 6, 7, 8,
yeah.
Or at 15, 16, 17.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. No, I fully get that. Yeah. It's as a parent, you know, it's a concerning thing that your child is developing at the same rate as other kids, right? Throughout. So, yes, I mean, the more that we allow this to be the abnormal to be, you know, considered normal, the better we are, right?
Well, look at my class going through school. I had 12 in my class, right? Out of that 12, there were two, a boy and a girl, that started puberty really early, and there were two that were very late, boy and a girl, coincidentally, in that small group.
Yeah,
right.
That's so true.
That's 2 out of 12.
Yeah, right? That's such an excellent point.
Right. So yeah. So it's not. And how many of them were trans? Well, there was me.
Right. Well, yes.
Me out of the 12, right? So 1 out of 12 in my small group was trans. Nobody knew. But 4 out of the 12 were affected.
Right.
By early or late.
Yeah.
And so you got to look at gender-affirming care also affecting those.
Right.
Right? So 5 out of 12, that's pretty close to 50%.
Well, right? And like you said, it's a spectrum in so many ways. Like you said, it can be just, not just, but mentally. Or it can be physically, or it can be emotionally.
Yeah,
right?
And you got to listen to the medical and scientific community too, because the thing is that here in Canada, there is no transition before 18.
Right. This is just it.
There was none.
No,
anyway,
nothing's happening here.
They're making a they're making a political thing about nothing.
Right. Yeah, this is not a problem. Like, I've never seen anybody say that, you know, I've been forced to become transgender. If anything, it's the opposite. Like you're saying, my child is suicidal because they know they're different and they want to be accepted, and we accept them.
Right. Exactly. They want to be accepted and they try to fit in and it's not working and they get depression.
Of course.
Right. And guess what? Depression lies to you. I've been there. I've had 2 serious suicide attempts myself, and I just about was successful in the last one. And the only thing was that I got interrupted. I got stopped. But depression had convinced me that the world was better off without me, right? Because what I was not acceptable to society.
Right.
And it convinced me that I better not exist. Like, the world would be better. The thing is that what they don't tell you is that taking that extreme affects all those that love you.
Right.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
You don't see the pain that it's going to cause the people that love you. Right? Even though you are in so much pain that's the only option you see.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Yes. And this is, you know, the opportunity that comes from your experience and people understanding your experience.
But with depression, you only see your hurt. That's it. You only see your pain.
Right. You can't see
because you're blinded. You can't see anybody else's.
Right.
Right? And that's what's going to happen to kids that can't be given puberty blockers. Puberty blockers is not, it's not HRT. It's not hormone replacement therapy. It's not transition therapy. Puberty blockers, all it does is stop the puberty that that child doesn't want at that time.
Right.
Right? Like, in my mind, it is almost child abuse, but to not give them puberty blockers. If they identify and they know they're a girl, but they're born a boy, and to make them go through that, through the boy transition, the boy puberty, that makes them so dysphoric 100%. later on. And it will make them suicidal. It gives them depression. And to me, that is a form of abuse.
Well, also, as you said, intersex children.
Yeah.
There are some kids that have, from what I understand, they have an absence of hormones and they need them in order to actually develop as an adult.
Exactly.
So we have to make sure that we're not looking at this as necessarily
as a binary black and white situation. Exactly. Because it's not.
No.
It's not. Again, it's a rainbow.
Right.
It's a rainbow.
Well, and this is what's so interesting, because when I think again, how, like you said, how it relates so many ways in science, when we use color to show many things,
right?
And we use it all the time. Like, for example, when I'm showing the variables that I'm looking at when I'm doing my work, you do that through multiple colors. And yet, for some reason, when it comes to society, we are still trying to put people in two categories.
Exactly.
And it is hurting all of us in doing that. And right. That's what I'm just so glad to hear you.
Okay. Think of this as okay. You know, the Fisher Price toy, the ball with the different shapes that you got to put the blocks in.
Yes.
Right. Right. That's gender.
Right.
Gender is like that. Right. You can't put the different shapes in only two holes.
Right.
Right. There's only two that goes in them, but there's all those other shapes. And that's what the actual true gender spectrum is. Mm-hmm. It's all those different shapes.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, I really appreciated all of this. And this is, there's so much to what you've offered me, Carrie, and I really appreciate it. The one question I do want to circle around to you, because again, I want to make sure that the work we're doing is honoring what our goals are. So just to be clear, we're trying to have conversations about the social, environmental, and economic crisis and how it's affecting us. So absolutely, right. Transgenderism is a big part of this, because it is about non-binary thinking and being able to think differently and all of that. So my question is, you know, I got here because I had a guest that I misinterpreted what they were offering. And so how do we do a better job? So again, I'm working on what is our process to make sure that we have the right people in the room and that we're having the right representation moving forward. So I'm curious let's just look at it from an Indigenous perspective or from a trans perspective, whichever you prefer. How do you, you know, I mean, let's pick one of them. If we're having conversations about Indigenous communities, I mean, it means clearly what's changed for me after this incident is to trust myself that the people that I'm meeting with when I'm seeking environmental justice and social justice things, those are the people that I should potentially be in conversation with. So that's one way I think that I'm going to help myself make sure that I'm on the right path. But if I have somebody, let's say, approach us or, you know, I just meet someone and think they're worth having a conversation with over this, what's some advice you can offer me in terms of making sure that this person is has genuine interest in what we're doing?
Okay, so I'm going to just kind of sidetrack just a little bit because you're talking about an incident, and that happens quite often, where you'll have somebody that approaches you that claims to represent the community, right? Turns out that they're not who they talk about. The thing is that in order to engage, like, the Indigenous perspective, talk to the communities, approach a band office, talk to the elders. A good way for the general public is approach the Native Friendship Centers. Mm. They are a good resource to initially approach in the Indigenous community, because they will know how to get a hold of elders, get in touch with elders of different communities, different nations. Right. Be very wary of somebody who comes up to you and claims to be a representative, because That's how you'll run into incidences where you find out that the person was white and pretending to be Indian. So-called pretendian, right? Even if they are a big advocate for the indigenous community, they might not be indigenous or legitimately indigenous in heritage. Again, you found me through a referral, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? Somebody that knows me, and you knew Holly is indigenous as well. She happens to be my cousin. That's a lot of times how you will be able to engage the right people, is finding your friends that whom you know are indigenous, right, who are status card carrying or card carrying members of the Métis Nation. That's how you actually get in touch with them and engage, right?
Yeah. Well, and it seems so obvious now, but I think it's because, you know, I'm not defending myself, but I'm in my other work. Let's leave, trying to make sure we're moving towards Indigenous ways of life, because that's quite honestly why I'm engaging with Indigenous communities, is because I understand we have to move away from Western culture, which is using too much of the Earth's resources, and we need to start actually caring for nature and restoring nature, right?
That's right.
This is my focus.
Like get take the resources out, yes, but then reclaim the land,
yes,
right? Put it back.
Right. And so that's my focus and why I'm engaging with the community. And so now it seems so obvious that I obviously do that with the people that are engaged in that work, So, which is great. And that's what, this has allowed me to do, is to connect with those people, like you said, and trust that community and build from that community. Yeah. So
let's get back to that last question.
Yeah.
That I've covered that little bit.
You. Yeah. I just, I'm trying to make sure that, you know, moving forward, this, I want to maintain, not only find representation, but have conversations that are maintained. How would you
open and keep communications open with communities, right? And the reason being, the biggest way to do that is touch bases every once in a while, on a regular basis, like not just
when you need something.
Not when you need something, like two or three years down the road. But, let's say you talk to a band office or an elder, right? And a couple weeks later, just shoot a quick text. How are you doing? But, it's something as simple as that.
Right, yeah.
Keeping the communications open, right?
Yeah.
And, checking in. Is there anything you'd like us to do?
Right.
That is also important. Quick pro quo.
Give and take.
And take, right? Because you ask stuff of the community, but then what can we do for you?
An expectation of reciprocity is so important.
Yeah. You got to remember that you're talking to a people that we operate on treaty. We didn't just do treaties with the crown, with white European colonists, but we also did treaties with each other,
right
with between each nations. Like we'd often have we had gathering of the nations, which happened to be what Custer had attacked the Battle of Little Bighorn. But it was a bunch of different nations that were together. It wasn't just the Lakota, but there was Kiowa, there was Comanche, there was different nations there, and that's where they sort out territories, where they're going to winter, where they're going to hunting and stuff like that,
right?
And cooperation, and that's also how many young Native people got partners, mates, because you didn't want to marry within the tribe, because all chances were you were too closely related,
right?
And the elders knew that, right? So there was oftentimes you arranged sort of, right? And then they would retaliate and steal a couple of the horses that were actually out to be stolen.
Right.
But so I mean, there was always a give and take. Indigenous culture is about balance, right? Balance of power, balance of spirituality, balance. Everything's in balance, right? And that's what we're looking at. You got to balance the harvest of resources with maintaining the environment. Right, which up until this point, big corporations have had a very, very poor track, very poor,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Look at all the abandoned oil wells.
Yes, thank you.
Right.
It's a $260 billion problem and opportunity.
Really, right.
Is how I look at it is it's our economy going forward. To me, it's the, and that's what's going to bring us together. And that's why I'm doing this conversation.
No, exactly. You didn't balance the harvesting of the resource with the maintaining the environment or maintaining or even thinking about like the cleanup afterwards, right? Yes. You didn't balance that.
No.
Didn't have the
time. Pushing it off. Binary thinking. Right? If we keep winning, if we keep growing, eventually we'll be able to do this.
You know, wells were sold between companies. Wells were sloughed off between companies. Oh, this company went bankrupt. All their oil wells are just abandoned. And it's like, no, so nobody's responsible for it. Well, I'm sorry, but the whole industry is.
100%.
Right? I'm sorry, but all of the companies are held accountable for every single oil well. It's not just the ones that own the well. It's the entire community of companies.
Right. That's right. The Orphan Well, that's precisely how they designed the Orphan Well Association, was whoever is here is responsible.
Period. It's not just the one that the defunct company that owned it, yes. Right?
Is there anything that you want to touch off before? Like, you're welcome to bring up anything that you'd love to just share with people, either about your journey or about, you know, like I said, I don't want to step over what you went through,
no.
You know, being a 60s scoop kid and also hearing, I didn't appreciate that they would do things like dress people in another gender to punish them in a sense. Like it's remarkable to me what you've gone through.
But they're talking about the government policies. They're talking about, you know, trans people going into our trans schools and making kids trans. No, guess what? The nun did that to me.
Right.
That was a white person. Right, to put me in a dress, not another trans person.
Right.
Don't tell me that it was trans people. Trans people aren't doing that. Trans people, we just want to exist. And I'm going to tell you, there is not a single place that is more full of love and acceptance than when you walk into a room full of trans people or even rainbow people. Right? Like, I joined a couple of different organizations, one of them being Rainbow Elders. Mm. And you walk in there and you instantly feel safe because you're in a room of queer LGBTQIA2S+ people, you know, all the letters of the rainbow. And there is nothing but love for each other in there. And if there was that kind of love for a fellow man everywhere else in society, there wouldn't be war. There wouldn't be conflict.
I fully get it. I went to my first Pride Festival 2 years ago or 3 years ago now, and I remember leaving there thinking that everybody's just so loving and supportive. What a wonderful community.
We're not trying to spread the hate. We're not the ones being hateful, because all we want to do is love everyone for who they are.
What a beautiful message.
We want to exist. We want to just be us. Be allowed the right to just be us. Bringing in policies like anti-trans policies, anti-gay or lesbian or whatever, right? Those, to me, are anti-human rights. I cannot wrap my head around how you can use legislation to override human rights or even their Bill of Human Rights. Like, how can you do that? How can you use the withstanding clause as what UCP is threatening to use, right? The non-withstanding clause. How can you do that to override the Bill of Human Rights?
Yeah.
How can you use that? I literally can't think how that is even possible.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think this is definitely in the discussion point for, and I'm going to make sure to follow up on that. Thank you.
Right.
That. Yeah. So thank you so much, Carrie.
You know, somebody asked me, how did you choose? Or why did you choose to be trans? I didn't choose. Like, why would I choose to risk losing everybody that I loved in my in my life, all my family, all my friends. Why would I risk that? Why would I risk that the hatred, like coming out and being the target of transphobia and homophobia and everything? Why would I risk becoming the target of my own government that would rather see me cease to exist? Why would I do that?
Of course, yeah.
Right? I didn't. I didn't choose. I didn't have a choice. If I had had a choice, I would have wanted to be part of general society. I would have wanted to be considered normal. I would have wanted to be hetero, whatever gender I was assigned. I was assigned male at birth. I would have wanted to be like male in my thinking and in being. I would have chosen that if I had the choice, but I didn't. I don't have the choice.
Yeah, and thank you for being brave to be yourself in spite of all of, like you said, the pressure on this community right now because of what it means for society. You know, I think it's a really big opportunity for us here to really come together in our human rights and our human care for each other as humans, period, and come through this a better people, a more aligned people.
And the reason why I've seen this in other jurisdictions, and the reason why they're using this issue and making it such a big issue is they're using it as a smokescreen so that they don't have to address the other really important issues like housing, our economy, right? Mm-hmm. Again, reclamation of those abandoned orphan wells.
That's right.
Like big issues. Yes. They're using the trans issue as a smokescreen, as a distraction. And people have got to realize that. Yes. And it's only a very small minority of one political party that has got the power,
right,
to drive the conversation, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's funny because I really do believe, and I think it's going to become more evident as we go on, that these issues are so tied with the environment too. Because we don't follow data when it comes to the environment either, like you're saying. So this is all, let's just let people be people. Let's make space for being in community with people that have genuine interest towards helping us.
And don't just pay lip service. Listen to what they're doing and actually work with them in coming up with policies.
Absolutely.
Right? Like literally get them truly involved.
Yeah.
And that's what you got to do. Even on corporate levels.
Yeah.
Right.
100%. Yeah. Thank you. Carrie, this has been amazing.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for your time. And I hope we get a chance to chat again.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.